Before I said, my name is Mike Sirks. I'm a third year graduate student here at the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes with Marty, and I'll be talking about summertime precipitation, extreme summertime precipitation in the Lake Mead watershed. And this work has been supported by Julie Klansky and Marty Ralph here at the center. Before I begin, I just want to say thanks for the previous presenters who really put a lot of this work into context, done a lot of the heavy lifting, as well as clarify that we're talking about summertime precipitation here, which we define as the months of July, August, and September, which roughly overlap for the North American monsoon season, which is a major player in the American southwestern summertime watersheds. So why study Lake Mead? As Janine mentioned, a few key points. Lake Mead is the second largest reservoir in the United States and is located along the Colorado River. The Colorado River serves over 40 million users, and with the help of Lake Mead has really become the lifeblood of the American West. However, historic overallocation of existing water resources and multi-decadal drought have led to a drastic decline in the Lake Mead reservoir elevation over the past few decades. On an annual average, 90% of the inflow into Lake Mead is simply released from the upstream reservoir of Lake Powell, which owes much of its inflow to the snowmelt of the Rocky Mountains. However, the remaining 10% of inflows generated locally within the Lake Mead Basin are not insignificant. In the summertime alone, the two largest Lake Mead tributaries contribute enough stream flow to be the equivalent of roughly 5 feet of storage reservation, storage elevation in the Lake Mead Reservoir. And for a reservoir like Lake Mead, which is so heavily litigated and has been teetering along the precipice of litigated threshold for shortage, its subsequent allocation cutback, a little bit of water can make all the difference. I don't think I need to convince this room of SWIP simians about the impacts of extreme precipitation, but as Catherine just put into context, this is an event. This photo is not in the Lake Mead watershed, but it's from this tropical storm Octave, which the National Weather Service highlights as a landfalling tropical cyclone remnants. However, owes much of the dynamical underpinnings to this event from larger scale synoptic features. So to put the Lake Mead watershed into geographical context in the upper right inlay, we see the outline of the watershed in a thin black contour. We've also plotted for reference the North American Monsoon Experiment Tier 1 and Tier 2 regions, denoted by dashed and solid lines, respectively. It's worth noting that much of the literature on the North American monsoon has really been focused on this Tier 1 region encompassing northwestern Mexico and southern Arizona. Lake Mead sits just to the northern periphery of this region. So we approach this work by first subsetting the larger Lake Mead watershed into sub-basins based on the existing USGS stream gauges located on these five major Lake Mead tributaries, which from west to east are the Las Vegas Wash, the Muddy River, the Virgin River, the Paria River, and the Little Colorado. It leaves watersheds 3 and 6, which exist along the Colorado River in between Lake Powell and Lake Mead, bifurcated by a single USGS stream gauge. And so just to put some future figures in context, we often highlight the differing precipitation characteristics across sub-basins. And so what we do is we list these watersheds from west to east along the x-axis, starting in the bottom left with the westernmost Las Vegas Wash and ending in the Little Colorado on the far right. However, just in case we run short out of time, I just wanted to highlight a few conclusions. So as I just mentioned, there's stark west-east precipitation gradients concerning the summertime characteristics. For the mean precipitation, the fraction of water year precipitation that falls during the summer, as well as the interannual variability of summertime precipitation. When we looked at the dominant drivers of extreme precipitation events during the summer, we found the anticyclonic Rossby wave breaking in the mid-latitude westerlies over the US West Coast were these dominant drivers. This is in contrast to the work that's been done in southern Arizona, which in northwestern Mexico, which really highlights the role that easterly waves play. So let's get to the precipitation. So we're using the PRISM 4 kilometer daily gridded precipitation product from 1981 through 2016, looking at July, August, and September. So we see here the mean summertime precipitation plotted. And for those of you familiar with the terrain, you'll notice a preference for higher precipitation along the elevated regions of terrain in the watershed, mainly the Magellan Rim, the Kaibab Plateau, as well as other isolated peaks. This is not surprising, as often we just saw this convective summertime precipitation prefers to initiate over the heated of these elevated terrain. We also see a general trend of the watershed being drier in the west and wetter in the east, with as few as 57 millimeters of precipitation falling on average in the summer of the Las Vegas Wash, up to 128 in the Little Colorado to the far east. If we look at how this summertime precipitation manifests in comparison to the water year precipitation, we again see a similar trend, where a smaller fraction of precipitation falls in the westernmost watersheds compared to the east, with values about 29% in the Las Vegas Wash, increasing to 44% in the Little Colorado. Trying to understand the interannual variability of summertime precipitation, we can plot the coefficient of variation, which is, our sigma has disappeared, but the standard deviation normalized by the mean. And so what we see again is a stark west to east gradient. However, this time larger valleys in the west, indicating larger variability from summertime to summertime in the western watershed, with values as high as 0.8 in the Las Vegas Wash, dropping to values around 0.3 for the Little Colorado. So now that we've seen just some first order statistics in the basin, and we see that there's a considerable amount of both spatial and temporal variability, we can start to parse out what sort of things are driving variability. So the first metric we'll look at is the role of the number of wet days in the summer. We define a wet day as a 24-hour period of precipitation exceeding 1 millimeter, and look at how that impacts the average total summertime precipitation. We can do this by plotting each basin as an ellipse whose center is marked by the mean X and Y variables. So for the entire Lake Mead watershed, we see about 30 wet days contributing to just over 100 millimeters of precipitation in the summer. Now the distance from the ellipse's center to the ellipse's edge in either the X or Y direction represents one standard deviation of that variable. So for example, 30 plus or minus 9 wet days corresponds to 100 plus or minus 30 millimeters of precipitation. And as we plot each subbasin accordingly, moving from west to east in warm to cool colors, we see a clear trend in the increase in the number of wet days as we move from west to east in the basin. What we also see is a trend in the obliquity of the ellipse. So if we take the Las Vegas Wash, the bright red ellipse, we see that only variability in only a few number of wet days corresponds to a large standard deviation in the total precipitation. However, this trend reverses in the far east in the corresponding entire Lake Mead watershed as well, which led us to believe that perhaps the role of extreme events is more important in the far western, more variable watersheds. And so to dig into that further, we define an extreme event as the 95th percentile of wet days, so the top 5% of all days whose precipitation exceeds 1 millimeter. And what we can do is look at the seasonal distribution of those events from by basin to basin and see if we can find any trends. And so what we do here is we plot basins along the x-axis, starting in the west with the Las Vegas Wash, moving to the east with the entire Lake Mead watershed shown on the far right. We're plotting the number of independent extreme events by month. And the first trend you'll notice is the tendency for the extreme events to increase as you move further east. However, this is simply an artifact of using a percentile approach, as basins that have a greater number of wet days will have a greater number of extreme events. Rather, the trend that we're interested in is that there's a skewness for extreme events to tend towards the later part of the summer, mainly August or September, as opposed to July in almost each of the basins, with the exception of Little Colorado. Previous work has attributed this trend to increasing tropical cyclone activity and increased landfalling of TCs and the remnants. In order to investigate that further, we use the IBTRAX data set, which tracks tropical cyclones, and we've tried to draw a control box near the head of the Gulf there to understand how often landfalling TCs are corresponding to extreme events. And in doing so, we flag those events, extreme events falling within 7 days of TCs passing, as red caps. And so what we see is, irrespective of TC counts, we see that extreme events still have a tendency to skew later in the season than the beginning. And so that prompts the question, why is that? What's happening? And so to investigate that further, we've created a catalog of extreme events for each basin and walk through case by case, looking through the synoptic drivers. As I mentioned before, our main finding is that it's actually not easterly disturbances in that impact southern Arizona. It's anticyclonic Grosby wave breaking in the mid-latitude westerlies. So we can look through a case example of that. So this storm is from late September 2007. We'll be plotting the MARA2 reanalysis products for the upper level 200 millibar potential vorticity, 2, 4, and 6 PVU contours as thin black lines, as well as the standard anomaly of those variables in the shaded contours. We also plot significant integrated vapor transport vectors, as well as a 33 millimeter integrated water vapor isoline as a proxy for high moisture values. So 5 days before the event, as we'll walk forward through the event, we'll see that we have a wave structure embedded in our PV field. 4 days before the event, this wave amplifies and subsequently breaks 3 days prior to the event, as we see a complete overturning of the 2, 4, and 6 PVU contours. whose inflection points are shown in the green here, which is often an objective method to define a Rossby wave break. You'll see that 2 days before the event, our flow begins to tear off as we see cyclonic circulation developing around our high PV feature. You'll note that the integrated water vapor isoline is still far south of the watershed at this time. However, as the cyclonic circulation begins to develop, and 1 day before the event, we see a complete separation and formation of a cutoff and closed low, we see the integrated water vapor surge into the southwest along the leading edge of the cyclonic anomaly. The day of the event, our PV feature is again picked up and evected to the northeast by the main steering flow. And what we see is, in combination with the most necessary ingredient of moisture, we also have competing circulations between the North American monsoon anticyclone ridge and our cyclonic circulation favoring upper level divergence, as well as a quasi-geostrophic dynamical kicker provided in the form of potential vorticity advection over the watershed, unleashing quite an extreme precipitation event. 1 day past the event, we see our features again evected and carried off by the mean flow to the northeast. So just to geek out with some of the satellite product here, we can look at a quick IR loop of this event period, and we'll point arrow. So we can see what we'll watch is this wave break over the west coast, cyclonic circulation develop, and then ushering in through a nice moist corridor into the southwest and carrying on. And so for those of you not familiar, the cool colors here will be high cloud top temperatures or intense convection. So we see here is a few days before the event, our wave begins to break as our flow tears off and subsequently cuts off and becomes completely separated from the mean flow as moisture surges into the southwest and is carried out into the interbasin and even into the Midwest. So we can now put this, we've seen the dynamics of the storm, we can now put it sort of in the context of precipitation. So for reference, our PV anomaly, our moisture, and our steering flow are listed here. So 24 hours prior to our extreme event, we see a large swath of precipitation impacting southern Nevada and parts of California with over 50 millimeters falling in just 24 hours. Fast forward to the 48-hour precipitation field, which now includes our extreme event, we see a significant addition of precipitation to the areas hit the day before, as well as a wide swath of precipitation falling over the Lake Mead Basin, northern Arizona, and southern and central Utah as well. The next day, the 72-hour precipitation field show that, again, over 50 millimeters of precipitation have fallen in southeastern Utah and western Wyoming. Putting this in context for the Lake Mead Basin, we had 37 millimeters fall in just 24 hours for the Virgin River Basin, which corresponded to 31% of the 2000 summer total for rainfall, which occurred, again, just in 24-hour period. In the 72-hour period, 43 millimeters fell in the Virgin Basin, which is corresponding to 43% of the long-term climatology for the summer. The Lake Mead Basin as a whole experienced on average 22 millimeters of precipitation, corresponding to 20% of the long-term summertime climatology for a summer. So we've really seen that this extreme precipitation event was quite extreme, and we can look at how the precipitation maps onto the Lake Mead Reservoir and see what we can look at from a stream flow generation standpoint. And to do so, we'll look at a time series of the USGS stream gauges along these basins. So we plot here as a time series with the month of September along the x-axis and stream flow on the y. And what we can do is for this time period of our event, which we see prior to was quite calm from a stream flow standpoint, we can just simply integrate under this curve, lopping off the base flow to get a really first order rough estimate on what the stream flow generation impacts of this event were. And using a value of about 10,000 acre feet per foot in the Lake Mead Reservoir, we see that the stream flow generated almost what's the equivalent of 1 foot behind the Lake Mead Reservoir, indicating that this really short-term 24-hour precipitation event was incredibly impactful for a reservoir like Mead, which has been teetering on the precipice of shortage. What we can also do is look at some of the hazardous impacts from this event, as we know this stream flow generation does not come without a cost. And to do that, we'll look at some of the NOAA storm report catalogs. So prior to the event, as the wave was breaking, there was the upper level jet streak surged through the southwest. And what we saw was intense winds leading to the unfortunate death of a kite surfer on the Lake Mead Reservoir. During the precipitation event, we saw heavy precipitation reported across the southwest into California as well, with flash flooding reports spanning nearly the entire Southwest from the Catalina Airport, Los Angeles, Death Valley National Park, Las Vegas, and into Zion National Park as well. Hail the size of golf balls was reported in the southern part of Lake Mead Reservoir, or Lake Mead Watershed in central Arizona as well. Thunderstorms knocked down power lines in Los Angeles, and a lightning strike in Las Vegas subsequently set a building on fire. There were reports of a tornado in Newport Beach, California, and several reports of waterspouts off the San Diego coastline, indicating that this is really an uncommonly extreme event, particularly from a dynamical standpoint, as well as from a precipitation standpoint. And to show the greater impacts of this Rossby wave breaking, behind the trough as a system is affected on cold air outbreaks from cold polar air cause rapid temperature drops and freezing warnings in the upper basin. It's also worth noting that in Los Angeles, one of the areas impacted by heavy precipitation had been recently burned in the previous year's wildfires and caused a post-fire debris flow, resulting in damages of over $30,000. So I think I'm gonna breeze through, had some composite analysis, but hopefully we'll have time for questions if we skip it. So Lake Mead watershed, on average, the whole thing, 43% of all extreme events were associated with these Rossby wave breaking setups. As we've highlighted some of the main features, such as a positive PV anomaly, overturning of our contour, competing circulation. So we have moisture, upper level divergence, and key geodynamics kicking off and triggering extreme events. If we contrast this to a well-known impactor of extreme precipitation in southern Arizona, that of the inverted trough or an easterly disturbance, we see that these only contributed to roughly 17% of our extreme events. And it's worth noting that if we increase our extreme event threshold from the 95th percentile valley, which for the entire Lake Mead watershed is roughly 7.5 millimeters, up to 10 millimeters, we see the fraction of Rossby wave breaking events jumps from 43% to 70%, indicating that these are really associated with the most intense precipitation in the Lake Mead watershed. And I want to bring up the inverted troughs as well, just to highlight on a few pieces of work being done on future climate, as our work is not at that stage yet. And so I just wanna talk really briefly about some conclusions from a paper by Lamers et al, which talks about historical track changes in inverted troughs using downscaled warp, and a study by Pascal et al that looked at the impact of increased CO2 on monsoonal moisture surges. So if we go back to our inverted trough dynamic, we see our monsoon high shown by this dashed circle in an inverted trough track scooping around the bottom, coming around the southwestern aspect into the southwest. This paper shows that this is already happening, but as we expect to see with global temperature increases, the monsoon ridge will subsequently strengthen, and as it does, will expand. The impacts of this is that inverted trough tracks will be displaced further south on average and have a decreased impact on the North American monsoon region, particularly for the southwestern United States. As this happens, this paper suggests that storms may become phase locked to the higher terrain regions as they lock the dynamical motivators to organize and propagate off of high plateaus into the lower deserts of Arizona. This can lead to multiple problems, including increased propensity for flooding in these higher elevation regions, as well as a decrease in water resources for the lower deserts. It's also worth noting that as global temperatures increase, our increased integrated water vapor isn't necessarily corresponding to increased precipitation. What is agreed upon is that extreme events will become more extreme, and the tails of the distributions will kick out to the side, as there's more water vapor to be unleashed during these extreme events. However, what we aren't sure about is how the decreases in relative humidity driven by increased surface heating will compete with the integrated water vapor. And so it's suspected that these low desert areas, so like Phoenix and Tucson, will become drier on average than will the elevated terrain. And lastly, I just wanted to, motivated by the work we've done in the Colorado River Basin that we're talking about, is if we see that Rossby wave breaking are really the dominant features for the Lake Mead watershed for extreme precipitation, and we expect to see inverted troughs, which already play a small role, to play an even smaller role in the future, might be even more important to study the impacts of Rossby wave breaking related extreme events in the general Southwest, as well as the Lake Mead watershed as well. It'll be equally important to understand what, if any, changes we expect to see between the relationship between these Rossby wave breaking events and a strengthened North American monsoon ridge. And with that, we'll just leave up a few of these previous conclusions and hopefully have time for a few questions.
Thanks, Mike, for a really interesting talk on the dynamics involved with these events. I'll open it up to some questions from the audience. Anyone has any?
So we saw that the cutoff low interacting with decaying tropical moisture is fairly common, and you mentioned that 2007 event that had a wide array of impacts. What were the things that differentiated that event from some of the other cutoff low tropical cyclone remnant interactions that made that one so extreme? Was it the amount of moisture or anything in particular?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if we sort of walk back. So not having looked at each case quite as closely from an impact standpoint, my guess would be one of the things that's led this event to be particularly impactful for Southern California. Let's see if we can get to the, there we go. Is so the sort of day before the event, day of the event, we did see a weak category one TC sort of being sheared apart far south just at the tip of Baja, which is sort of outside the range most people would look at for whether a TC is either making landfall or even outside of the range where most people would talk about TC remnants. But we have this really strong wave break over the US West Coast with really strong dynamics associated with this upper level potential electricity and this cold core cutoff low. And I think the fact that this becomes completely separated from the main flow and really stalls over California, just tapping into that tropical moisture pool for what is really, you know, more than a 48-hour period is my best guess on sort of the as Catherine mentioned, there's these uncommon occurrences of the interactions between one, you still have your monsoon ridge funneling in moisture on the like across the watershed from a dipole perspective. You have cyclonic watershed, anticyclonic funneling the moisture, as well as the strong dynamics provided by your potential vorticity would be my guess.
I'll make a note from an event that happened this year around December 5th. We had a system that looked a lot like this, and we were tracking an AR coming onshore for a radar experiment that we were running, and we were noting that the AR was actually going to look fairly weak in this case. And I was talking with Adam Hutchinson from Orange County Water District, and I was telling him, oh yeah, I don't think you guys will get too much up your way from this. And then this little exact same kind of cutoff low feature came and parked itself over their watershed. And he sends me an email. He's like, hey, Forrest, my kids are home from school, 3 inches of rain, something like that. It's like, what happened with your forecast? So it's something we're working on. Don't give me too hard of a time. But yeah, just an anecdotal evidence from this year. It impacts much of the West and not just to Southern California as well. Another question from the audience?
I want to thank you for this really interesting talk about an area that I could never understand up on the plateau and how that interacts with, and what the system you're talking about is just so reminiscent of several of the others, some really big flash flood death events that have occurred, and and for filling in the part I didn't talk about, that it's not just the TCs, it's also all the other things coming together. So great.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
I think just a selfish plug for this type of work is that a lot of the work done on landfalling TCs in the Southwest have shown that one of the main drivers for TCs gaining that northern trajectory is, one, they have to first form in the right spot off the coast of Mexico. But it is these large-scale troughs that come in from the mid-latitudes that really attribute this northerly track to these TCs. And so while at some point you have to make a decision on what you're calling a landfalling TC and what you're not, what you're calling a TC remnant and what you're not, if a feature has made it that far north, it's very likely that maybe not a Rossby wave break, but a large-scale synoptic trough has come through and infected that north into the watershed.
And from a climatological perspective, it's also why these things happen in September,
exactly,
in October, because you're close enough to the synoptic flows beginning then. You know, that was something I could never figure out. Why is this only happening then?
Yeah, exactly. So as you get closer to winter, your jet expands over the Pacific, and that's sort of where the region of Rossby wave breaking, if you look at the climatology, moves across the Pacific, and the energetics in that jet really provide the instability.
Just a suggestion is, let's look beyond this and see if there are any indications of something going on in the upper Great Plains or, you know, other parts of the, you know, West or Central U.S. in the following days. Just curious.
Yeah, I think there's some nice possibilities for future work. I know there's a paper that Nina worked on that looked at sort of the impact of cutoff and close lows on precipitation throughout the West and how often these Rossby wave breaks result in those sort of flows, and looking beyond the summer season and looking just beyond the Lakewood watershed. I think all have some impacts that would be helpful to the community.
Yeah, it might be helpful too, because when you think of this and how few events you actually have in terms of establishing what the predictability of these kinds of things are, where you've got two different mechanisms interacting with each other, and it has really only happened a handful of times in the record. There's no real index of extremes here. Expanding the domain, expanding how you look at this may provide some added insight into the predictability. Okay, if